This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
If we can bend the curve, if we can make sure that people have access to cooling, at the same time get cooling sustainably by 2050, the world will be a better world.
That's Omar Abelaziz from American University in Cairo on a new UN report on the possibility of cutting emissions by 60% by 2050. Details coming up. Also, a Nigerian army drone targeting armed groups killed at least 85 civilians by mistake. And the United Nations warns that renewed fighting between Israel and Hamas will lead to an even more hellish scenario. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Sierra Leone remains calm after a coup attempt late last month. The government says it has arrested more than 50 people for allegedly being involved when armed attackers stormed a military armory, two barracks, two prisons, and two police stations, clashing with security forces during the early hours of November 26. President Julius Maada Bio has said the response for the coup bid would be dictated by respect for the law. Many residents are concerned about the coup's after effects, especially a nightly 9-hour curfew that begins at 9 p.m. Mohamed King Milan is a Sierra Leonean national radio and television entertainment reporter. He tells VOA's David Van Dee the coup attempt's aftermath is hitting the entertainment industry.
How has this failed coup attempt and the government's declaration of a nationwide curfew in Sierra Leone affected the entertainment industry?
The entertainment industry has been affected greatly by those stuff, you know, by the failed coup and, of course, the curfew as well. The time like this, December, you know, is a time where most of the activities taking place in the country. A lot of people coming into the country to celebrate their holidays with their parents and families as well. And it has come to a point where in every December, it is like Jamaica or the Caribbean states. We are in people coming and have a good time. But with the coffee attempt and the coffee as well, everything is set back. Shows that are supposed to be organized are now cancelled. And business places as well closing up their business as well. Because the coffee is now 9 p.m. So people are not going out as well. Of course, from 6, 7, people are starting to go back home. So the failed coup and, of course, the coffee as well definitely affected the entertainment industry.
You talked about businesses. So what are you hearing from business owners that were looking to make more profit this December, as December is a month of festivities?
Oh, they're heartbroken. They're heartbroken seriously because most of them have already put things in place, spend a lot, you know, in terms of organizing their businesses. Some are coming in with businesses, things that has to do with the holidays as well, especially December like this one. So what I had, most of them, they're feeling downcast right now because they're in losses big time, you know, because what they're supposed to come in to invest and get their profits as well is no more happening right now, especially where the coffee is on right now. So they are not too happy, so it is not good for them at all.
But when you look at it, it is for security reasons, because nobody was expecting this to happen. And out of the blues of that November 26th, it just happened. And the government have to put measures in place.
Yeah, definitely, I agree with that. Security is the first thing, you know. And at a time like this, wherein the government needs to secure the nation, I think it's up to them to set up a curfew. And I think the business people have to strategize something else, look for somewhere or rather somehow again to rekindle or rather redo some of their business. Maybe it's something, I hope, before Christmas they will lift the curfew and back again. But for now, it's serious. And of course, nobody's going to blame the government. It's something about security. So they have the right to do what they do.
And finally, King Milan, popular rapper, musician, LJ, as he's fondly called, who was released from the Pademba Road Correctional Facility by the attackers of November 26th, has voluntarily torn himself in back to the prison authorities to continue serving his sentence. As someone who has been in the entertainment industry for over two decades, did LAJ do the right thing?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. He did well. He did well. You know, that's what, when that happened, when he was released on that day, people were anticipating he might come in or maybe run away somewhere. But he's a popular figure. Of course, among all those released, he was the one people are definitely eyeing on, of course, waiting to see his outcome. So what he did, returning himself back into the Panebagot prison alongside his lawyer so far, he did the right thing, especially educating people that he, being a prisoner, being released unlawfully, I think that's not right. Let him come back, and of course, the government, it's up to the government to pardon him later. Doing what he did, he has got a lot of fans again, you know, though he was very popular, but now he's got a lot of fans as well that love him for what he did. So I think I endorse to that, and of course, I support him as well.
That was Mohammed King Milan, a Sierra Leonean national radio and television entertainment reporter, speaking with my colleague David Van Dee. A Nigerian army drone targeting armed groups killed at least 85 civilians by mistake in northwest Kaduna State. President Bola Ahmed Tinubu called the incident disturbing and ordered an investigation. The army has acknowledged one of its drones mistakenly struck in Tudun Biri village on Sunday as residents celebrated the Muslim festival of Maulud. The army did not give any casualty figures, but residents said 85 people, many of them women and children, were killed. Initially, the army said its drone was on a routine mission that inadvertently affected members of the community. Later, it said the villagers had been mistaken for an armed group in the area. The National Emergency Management Agency said that 85 were killed and 66 people were being treated at a hospital. The French news agency AFP says emergency officials are negotiating with community leaders to calm tensions to be able to reach the village. The GovAL conference today and tomorrow brings together software developers with government agencies, militaries, and educational institutions to make the case for public sector use of artificial intelligence. VOA's Anthony Labruto is at the scene and joins us live by phone. Welcome, Anthony.
Hello, Yehia. Thank you very much.
So, what's happening at the conference right now?
So far at this conference, and I'd like to point out this is actually the first of its kind U.S.-based artificial intelligence government summit. There's been several presentations from artificial intelligence developers, the keynote speaker actually being OpenAI, which is the founders of ChatGPT, and a lot of smaller startups that are looking to grow their business towards the government. There's also been a lot of presentations from different United States government agencies, mostly the Department of Homeland Security and the Transportation Security Administration that oversees things like airports, scanning luggage, that sort of thing. And so far from what we've seen in the event, it's sort of both sides of it, I guess you could say, is the artificial intelligence developers on one side and the public sector workers of this conference listening to one another and what the public sector is looking for in artificial intelligence, and on the flip side, what artificial intelligence can create and do that can be adapted for their individual needs.
I'm just curious, Anthony, why is there a need for artificial intelligence developers to target public sector workers specifically through this conference?
From what I've heard, particularly from government agencies speaking at this conference, and there's sort of an underlying fear of artificial intelligence taking over the current technology conversation and security really being at the heart of that. And so who has access to, say, mass camera surveillance technology, facial recognition, higher computing power? And definitely seeing and speaking with developers, artificial intelligence is being utilized and developed quicker and quicker since the creation of ChatGPT, which is the first kind of major, what they call interactive language model that you can communicate with that will give you information back. And so government agencies, particularly the Transportation Security Administration, like I mentioned earlier, are keen to embrace this technology because they know it's extremely effective, but don't really know where to start. And that was pretty evident from their initial presentation. And some of the government representatives I've spoken to on the side of the event are a little concerned if they're too high of embracing artificial intelligence as a whole. But developers really want to try to combat that, to change that concern to excitement for what the technology is rather than a fear of it.
And lastly, is there a willingness between software developers and public sector workers to want to work together on artificial intelligence issues?
Absolutely. Based on what's being presented at this conference, this is really the start of where, at least from a United States perspective, the groups of the public sector worker and artificial intelligence developer can come together to create better software and artificial intelligence models that can be applied in a variety of ways, and you know, from firefighters, doctors, airport security, or even trains. But there's really, at the heart of it, a lot of skepticism coming to light from the public sector, and rightfully so. You know, these public sector workers can see that artificial intelligence, it's been around barely less than 5 years, has the possibility to upend entire industries and displace many people from their jobs. But what these small tech exhibitions kind of off to the side of the event space, what they're trying to do is they're marketing towards the public sector workers in a different way, you know, rather than, oh, we're here to upend everything. It's more, how can we help you? What can we do to make your jobs more efficient? And at this point, I'm not too sure many public sector workers within the conference here can answer that question very specifically, but the fact that there's a willingness to even listen and offer suggestions to these developers and really, you know, for them to listen would be seen as a very, very encouraging sign for the artificial intelligence industry here.
VOA's Anthony Labruto reporting live at the GovAll conference. Thank you for your input.
Thank you.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Guinea-Bissau's President Umaro Sissoco Mbalo has dissolved the parliament after saying last week that there was an attempt to overthrow the government of the West African country. Mbalo cited persistent and unresolvable differences with parliament, which he described as a space for guerrilla politics and plotting. David Mondo is a professor of political science, American government, and international affairs at City University of New York. He tells me that the president dissolving parliament, an important arm of the government, shows instability in Guinea-Bissau.
I think it's a very dangerous aid because it really shows that President Umaro Mbalo is looking to consolidate his power. And he's done that by dissolving the parliament. So that's a very important arm of government. In other words, the people can't make laws. The budget can't be decided. So the president is almost, he's going to rule by decree because a very important arm of government has been, has been dissolved. But I think more importantly, it shows the instability in Guinea-Bissau.
And you are very right, Professor. The former Portuguese colony of about 2 million people is unstable and has suffered 4 military coups since 1974, most recently in 2012. Talk to us about the politics of Guinea-Bissau over the years.
So the politics has been very difficult because in 1974, with the assassination of Amilcar Cabral, you already see a process where extra-constitutional means were being used to access power, even back then in 1974. So fast forward till today, we still see the same problem where extra-constitutional means, in this case through coup d'etat, are being attempted by opponents of the president in order to get him out. And this also brings us to the broader question of military coup d'etat contagion, where we've had this whole region of the Sahel, even all the way to Central Africa, to Gabon, where military governments have been taking over power. And now it seems that the contagious effect of coup d'etats in the Sahel has finally also reached Guinea-Bissau.
Professor Mbalo has dissolved Guinea-Bissau's parliament in May 2022 after he accused some authorities of corruption and other issues. So this tension between parliament and the presidency have gripped the West African state for months. The president actually has clashed with the parliament over distribution of oil resources at the border with Senegal, about revision of the constitution, and a peacekeeping force from West Africa's regional bloc, ECOWAS. So he's constantly clashing with the parliament.
Very much so. Very much so. And let's also not forget that Guinea-Bissau has a semi-presidential system. So that further limits the president's power, because parliament also has a very strong say in the framing of the prime minister. Parliament also has a strong power in deciding how government is run. And right now it seems this tension between the two heads of the executive, meaning the president and parliament, the heads of the parliament, are really coming forward. And it's a really big struggle.
So moving forward, Professor, presidential decree has said the parliamentary elections would be held on December 18th. What happens to moving forward for Guinea-Bissau?
Right now it's very difficult to tell. So on one hand, domestically, like we said before, what will the role of the military be, given that the president has decided to rule? Essentially, he's ruling by decree because he's cut out the legislature. And in addition to that, what will the reaction of the parliament, the members who've been sidelined in the parliament, what will their reaction be? Let's not forget, Guinea-Bissau has had a history of very violent reprisals. At independence, about 8,000 former, African Guinea-Bissau troops refused to join the National Military Army and were summarily executed. That was in the 70s, over 8,000 soldiers. So they've had this history of very violent attempts to take over power. And it's going to be interesting to see where the military will be in the context of this fight between the parliament and detractors of the president on one hand, and then the president Embalo's effort to try and consolidate his position. I think, and lastly, the other interesting element will be, what will the role of the former colonial power and Western interests be in terms of trying to maintain stability in Guinea-Bissau? Will Portugal have an interest in trying to negotiate some kind of settlement there? And then what happens with the ECOWAS, the regional peacekeeping force that already has a hand in Guinea-Bissau?
That was David Monda, a professor of political science, American government and international affairs at City University of New York. He talked to me from New York. Just a short time ago, the United States government said it had imposed visa restrictions on Israeli settlers who have been involved in violent attacks against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. The State Department said the U.S. government will continue to work with Israeli leadership to protect Palestinian civilians from extremists, and also will work with the Palestinian Authority to reduce attacks on Israelis. Fierce fighting continues in the community of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. The Israeli Defense Forces launched its assault in the area earlier today. The offensive led to a United Nations warning that southern Gaza will lead to an even more hellish scenario as civilians flee into the limited safe areas. Lebanon's government says one of its soldiers died today and others were injured when they exchanged fire with Israeli forces across the border. The United Nations has said the air and ground assault has displaced about 80% of Gaza's 2.3 million people. The Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry says nearly 16,000 people have died, most of them women and children. Israel says about 1,200 Israelis and foreign nationals died in the October 7th attacks, and Hamas took about 240 hostages back to Gaza. A week-long truce, which ended last Friday, saw Hamas free more than 100 hostages, while Israelis freed 240 Palestinians held in its prisons. A new United Nations Environment Program report released today at the COP28 Climate Summit offers key measures to reduce power consumption of cooling equipment that would cut at least 60% off predicted emissions by 2050. Omar Abdelaziz, one of the lead authors of the report and assistant professor at the American University in Cairo in the Department of Mechanical Engineering, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that he and others were able to unlock cooling strategies that could take the pressure off energy grids and cut predicted emissions by up to 96% by 2050.
The first thing was to look how to use passive cooling technologies in the building sector and in the cold chain to reduce the demand for cooling, and found out that with the current technologies, we can reduce 24% of the demand by 2050. Then we said, can we use available technologies, energy efficient cooling technologies, to improve the equipment stock? So imagine that cooling is two things. There is a building that you need to cool, and then there is an equipment like an air conditioner that you use to cool the building with. So the first thing is how to make the building more efficient, or to make the building energy efficient, and now how to make the equipment also more energy efficient. And we found out that current technologies are up to 3 times more efficient than what is available on the market. So how can we push the limit and just use the most efficient technologies and have higher market penetration of the high energy efficient technologies? And then can we use lower global warming potential refrigerants and accelerate the phase down of high global warming potential refrigerants? Basically, there is the Kigali Amendment to the Montreal Protocol, and we want to accelerate the Kigali Amendment.
So let me take the first one. You talk about the buildings. You can do things to make the buildings 25% more efficient. Does that mean you work with existing buildings, or that this is in the future for buildings that will be built?
It's actually a part of both, because we, in the modeling, we accounted for both how we can retrofit current buildings and also future building stock. Imagine that in India, for example, the current building stock is going to double by 2050. So it's like you are building New York City every couple of years. So there is a huge demand growth for buildings in the developing world, right? So we have to be careful and make sure that we are not building stock or building buildings that are not energy efficient. At the same time, how we can make sure that the buildings that are being available right now to us, to retrofit it so that we can use cooling and heating more efficiently.
You mentioned in your report that this could especially benefit Africa. How so? What's happening in Africa that you can apply these methods to?
So right now in Africa, access to cooling is very poor. And what we want is maximize the access to cooling and make sure that there is at least one refrigerator for each household. And hopefully there is also one air conditioner for each household, because with extreme heat, you need the cooling to provide livelihood for everyone. This is in 2050. That means you need an additional 3.5 billion people to cover under this cooling initiative. And this is a significant stock of equipment. With the sustainable growth, with reducing the demand, we made way for allowing access to nations in Africa and Asia.
You know, your report's being released in conjunction with the cooling pledge that's being announced today. Are you confident that, you know, most nations will sign on to this cooling pledge and it will be carried out?
So that's what we will see in a few minutes. And that's my hope. I am a hopeful person. And I set on this pathway to write this report because I want to make sure that there is a potential for change. The cooling is an important sector. And if we can make a dent, if we can bend the curve, if we can make sure that people have access to cooling, at the same time, get cooling sustainably by 2050, the world will be a better world.
That's Omar Abdelaziz, assistant professor at the American University in Cairo and one of the lead authors of a new UNEP report on cooling. He was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam from COP28 in Dubai.
Join your host Larry London for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
And Niger's military leaders say they are ending two European Union security and defense missions after agreeing to strengthen military cooperation with Russia. The Nigerian Foreign Ministry says it is ending the agreement between Niger and the EU regarding the Niamey-based civilian capacity building mission called EUCAP Sahel Niger. Launched in 2012, it supports Niger's internal security forces. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Joe Gill, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.